Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 37. On this episode, we are talking about Fight Club, which means that we're breaking the first two rules of Fight Club. Anytime I need someone to help me break rules, I always call on Griffin Kale. So he's joining us on this episode, and for his first time ever, new to Real World Theology, our current written article guru, Josh Crabb, who is a new partner at Real World Theology, and he's going to be on the podcast a lot more. He is a super contributor at the site and someone who easily falls in line with the mission of Real World Theology, and it's very exciting to have him on. But to Fight Club. So Fight Club is almost 15 years old. We're doing this for two reasons. One, the 15th anniversary is in about 2 weeks, and it's a David Fincher film, and we'll probably be doing Gone Girl in the next couple weeks as well. So it kind of had a theme there. Lots of you guys have been asking for us to do older movies, and we were like, this is a perfect chance to do one of our favorite older films. This film, highly influential. It deals with consumerism, identity, God as a father, guy communication or the lack thereof. And we also get a chance to talk about what may have been our generation's best year ever in film. So, here it is, episode 37, Fight Club, and letting our stuff define us. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Yes.
So I can find ways to get you more involved. Because, you know, I like passing the buck, which is why Griffin's here.
Ba-ba-da-ba-ba.
Woo!
But, so... You have, I don't think I told Griffin this, but technically you picked this movie.
Yeah.
That we're going to be doing tonight.
Okay, Joshua, I applaud you, sir, because I've tried to pick so many movies, and not a single one has been even like past stage one of the bill process. It's like, I'm a bill.
You're just sitting lonely on the steps waiting for a child from the 70s to come and talk to you about it.
Yep. He's a bill, and he went to Fizz to get killed. That's what happened. So we're hopefully changing things. And this is something that I'd probably talk more about maybe a little bit at the end of the show. Mm. And, you know, to a certain degree, maybe I'll even write up a post about it to kind of formally announce it. But, you know, Josh, you know, I've been talking. And having a dedicated person teaming up for Real World Theology gives us the opportunity to pretty easily podcast three times a month. Mm-hmm. Which will, during slower movie seasons, which I would say is probably...
Currently.
Currently.
Right
definitely.
Now.
Well, we just did the Lego movie last, you know, and yeah. Even though it's not like a classic old movie or older movie, it's still one that it's on DVD, so people who don't go to the theater can have already seen it. Blu-ray?
Okay.
Digital?
Oh, okay, I got
they,
you.
They, no, I got rented you. It on iTunes.
Sorry, you were saying DVD. I thought I heard VHS in there somewhere. I was like,
oh, God. So speaking of VHS, so I was
actually totally... I have a Laserdisc copy of this.
Whoa.
No, I'm totally kidding. No, no.
I was going to say,
no,
I think
back
I just...
off the train. That was it.
That's like the vinyl version of Fight Club.
you have to listen to Fight Club on vinyl. It's just
so much better.
It's much richer and smoother.
There's so much texture to the sound.
I know. You can really tell how much they really hate consumerism. It's just right there.
You can smell them. You can smell the sweat and the blood.
Well, the funny thing is, so I've been meaning to, you know, I've seen this movie at least a dozen times. I mean, it's been out for a long time. So I've seen this movie probably a dozen times. But as usual, knowing that I'm going to be podcasting about a movie, I take the time to watch it sometime in advance, or I do everything I can to watch it in advance.
Yep.
So I was like, I know I have this movie. I know I have this movie.
You had it on VCR, didn't you?
On VCR?
on your VCR?
VHS.
The VHS copy?
Yes.
I thought you had it digitally on your VHR.
Into the VCR.
That's what I was trying to say is that you had it preloaded.
Yeah, so I assumed that I had a DVD or Blu-ray copy of it because I was like, oh, man, I remember when the 10th anniversary came out. I'm totally going to get the nice Blu-ray. Never did. So I had it on VHS, but I have no VCR.
You want to know my favorite part about that Blu-ray, that 10th anniversary Blu-ray, is when you first put it in, the screen that pops up has never been kissed. And it stays up for like a few seconds. And then it starts like slowly, like it breaks, and then like it like kind of like it does that thing where like it's like your screen's about to die. Like it's like, shh, and it does that for like a good 5 or 6 more seconds, and then you get the Fight Club screen. And at first you're like, what the heck is wrong with this DVD? I did not buy this. This is some Fight Club on the front. It says Fight Club on the cover, and I, for some reason, Never Been Kissed is coming out.
Well, either way, I realized that it had been a while.
It had been a while. So
awesome. And this is long overdue. One, for us, this is an excellent choice for us to talk about on the podcast, especially this type of podcast. And not to steal some of your thunder, Josh, but I believe when I asked you to pick a movie that was one of your favorites, since I was going to start having you on the show, you not only picked it because it was one of your favorites, but you also picked it because as of the day of airing of this show, it'll be, I don't know, within like a couple days, 15 days or so of the 15th anniversary. Is that?
Yep.
Yep. So, I mean, think about that. Like,
well, yes, and then you guys know that the guy who wrote the book is, like, doing the sequel in comics.
Oh, in comics?
Oh, in comics, really?
Okay, because I thought I heard that he was doing a sequel.
He's writing the sequel, and it's gonna be a comic, yeah.
So I'm going to say this. I'm going to say it wrong so you can fix it, okay? Chuck Palahniuk?
I think that's right. I don't know that that's wrong.
That's how I've pronounced it for 15 years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so, the guy who's drawing it's Cameron Stewart, who's like incredible. Hmm. Just really talented guy who doesn't do enough work. But.
Well, I remember reading, after Fight Club came out, I remember reading another Chuck Palahniuk book. I think it was called Invisible Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
We should have looked that up before the show. But between Fight Club and this and Invisible Monsters, we'll call it. We'll just say it's Invisible Monsters because I'm too lazy to look it up.
It is Invisible Monsters.
Like that, I remember going to college and like those kind of like being my mantra for entering college. Mm-hmm. Like screw everybody. Like I'm gonna do what I want. Like I'm not gonna be oppressed by the man. I'm not gonna bow to people telling me what's cool and not. And I just thought I was the stuff. And I was the stuff.
So. Who's to say you weren't?
And I was the only person telling me if I was the stuff or not. So
yeah.
Well, actually, hopefully the statute of limitations is gone on this story. But yeah, this was like for my friends and I growing up, like Fight Club was like our call to action in high school because I was like a freshman or a sophomore or something like that in high school when this came out, and we actually. As a part of this, we did like a scavenger hunt where basically it was kind of a vandalism scavenger hunt.
Yes. like mayhem scavenger hunt. You're just let's do it.
Yeah, pretty much. And I ended up with like a trunk full of stuff that like I basically had to go pitch in like a field somewhere. And it was pretty epic and pretty awesome. And you know, when you're a 15 or 14 or 15 year old kid, it's like the coolest thing you've ever done. But if my kids did it, I'd beat them senseless.
No, there's I know, I mean, I feel like I know exactly how you feel, because this is where I was right around the time this movie came out.
Mm-hmm.
We were just looking for excuses to like feel alive. We'll talk about when we really get into the movie, like we were a little too scared and kind of goody-goody to be real super vandals.
Oh, totally.
But we would, you know, we would take road cones, we would go to a construction site and tip porta-johns over in the middle of the night. We would throw food at mailboxes on our way home. We would stay up. Oh, one of our favorite stories, anyone who's ever had a conversation with me about my childhood, while one of my best friends is in the room, he always tells a story about how we kind of would always just mess with the trash men, because where we were during the summer, they would always come at like 3 a.m, you know, because it was hot, so they'd get it all done at night instead. So we would all, everyone would sleep over at my house. We'd go out in the middle of the night, and we lived in a cul-de-sac. So the trash guys would come down, empty the trash cans, and they'd drive like the quarter mile down to the end of the cul-de-sac. We'd be in strategic locations, just like Project Mayhem. We'd all run out, get like trash cans from, you know, a dozen houses, and like pile or stack them in a pyramid in the middle of the road, and then run. So all that really happened was that the garbage men would have to stop on their way back and kick all the trash cans out of the middle of the road so they could drive through. And you could hear them swearing and being like, really? I mean, because that had to be one of the weirdest things in the world, because they never saw us.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're just like, it's 3 a.m., I'm emptying trash cans, and I gotta do, you know.
Gotta deal with some damn kids. Exactly. Being like, let's play a trick on the trash man.
Exactly. So, I mean, like I said, we were a little too goody to, like, I think do any real damage.
Right.
But we just wanted to do these things to, like, just buck the system, feel alive, and just, like, Fight Club came along, Chuck Palahniuk's books came along, and just put words and ideas to these feelings. And as you know, we'll have links and stuff later. We'll talk about some very self-aware Edward Norton quotes that we have, and Brad Pitt quotes and stuff. So, but we will, I guess, officially break the first rule of Fight Club by talking about Fight Club. Okay. Joke copyright Mark Wingarter.
Yeah, we've just been like ironically just doing this whole podcast. I mean, this podcast from start to finish is the most ironic thing you can do.
Yeah, so we are breaking the first and second rule of Fight Club by talking about Fight Club on the podcast tonight. The film I love because almost any description I read of it is, I'm like, oh man, that's it. It's like lots of great movies that I love. The description never really tells you, mm-mm, like, why you're going to love the film. So I grabbed two.
I mean, the thing is, man, this is the first movie that I got to the end of, and I was like, what? That? The whole time?
Yep.
And I remember going, like, I remember the second time I watched it, or maybe even the third or fourth time I watched it. Just, like, you start seeing all of the things, and you start realizing everything. Like, all the conversations that he has with what's her name? Crap.
Marla.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, she's like, you're crazy.
Yeah.
And then you're like, he's not crazy. You're sleeping with his best friend.
Exactly.
And it's like, oh, he is crazy.
He is crazy. Well, I mean, it explains why it was one of the, you know, top box office flops of all time. I mean, this movie, at least the figures I found, said it made $37 million in its theatrical release, which was, I think, just over half of the actual production budget.
Wow.
So it completely flopped, even though I went to see it twice, because as soon as I got out, much like Griffin, I basically was like, well, I got to do this again.
Yeah, because there's so much. You start seeing Tyler, like, way early in the movie, like, in those, like, flash scenes where, like, they just, like, cut in, a scene of him. I mean, yeah.
Or in the commercial that he's watching for the... Josh sent out a really great link before the show about, like, you know, 10 things, your 25 things you didn't know about
Fight Club.
And when I was like, Brad Pitt is in this commercial that Edward Norton, the narrator's character, is watching in one of the hotel rooms.
Uh-huh.
And it's like everyone in like tuxedos and stuff being like, welcome to the hotel. And right there on the end,
it's Brad Pitt. Yeah.
It's Brad Pitt.
It's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, he walks by him and whenever he's in the airport.
Yeah.
One time, like, they're walking down the walkways and he's walking, going by him this way.
It's just, anyway. So, but at the same time, okay, so it only made $37 million.
Okay.
All right. And I can understand that because when I get out, I'm trying to explain it to people. And like I said, IMDb says, like, you know, this is what Fight Club is. An insomniac office worker looking for a way to change his life crosses paths with a devil may care. I mean, who uses that phrase? Devil may care?
Who work for IMDb.
Apparently.
So a devil may care soap maker, and they form an underground fight club that evolves into something much, much more. Da, 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 da. And I'm like, okay, but it doesn't... Anyway, I don't...
Psycho thriller. Yeah. Psycho thriller.
Psycho thriller.
Yeah.
So what was the other one I read? I don't remember where I got this one from, but it said a ticking time bomb, insomniac, and a slippery soap salesman. Apparently they were kind of alliteration, maybe.
Yeah.
Channeled primal male aggression into a shocking new form of therapy.
They had just learned about tongue twisters in elementary school.
They did.
They were like, oh, Tony sells seashells by the seashore, yeah.
But, I mean, like, that was the thing, and... Like one of the things, or what I figured we'd end up having to talk about on the show, is that there's kind of two venues that you can talk about this movie. One is you can actually talk about the movie itself. I mean, the writing, the dialogue. I mean, as a film, it's great. The ideas that it puts forth. Honestly, the wealth of things that we can talk about just from this movie that we've already been hitting on just in the preamble to the show. I mean, it's so deep. Okay, mm-hmm. So there's the film itself. But then there's the cultural impact it has. This movie, you know, it's directed by David Fincher. At the time, David Fincher had done, like, the something game.
Called The Game, wasn't it?
Yeah, maybe it was just called The Game.
Yeah, it's the one where the guy, like, it looks like a jigsaw puzzle on the cover, right?
Yeah, so yeah. He did The Game. It wasn't that great. But he had just done Seven, you know, and Seven kind of...
Seven. So good.
Seven's so amazing.
It's amazing.
But so he hits this one. And then, you know, now David Fincher, very appropriately, I think our next podcast is going to be another David Fincher film. Gone Girl in a couple weeks.
I mean, this is the guy who did, I mean, whether you like it or not, Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
Like, this is the guy who directed who created the American version of House of Cards, which you all love. Like, mm-hmm. He's like, I'm going to direct the first two episodes and get this ball rolling. So, yeah. Social Network. I'm just looking at. I mean, just so many fantastic movies.
Yeah, the Panic Room. He's got a ton of stuff under his belt now. To the point where if David Fincher directs a movie, I will go see that.
No,
movie.
I'll go see it because he's a director in that right of like, I will see that. I will see everything he makes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm guessing Josh, you feel the same way.
Pretty much. I mean, he hasn't really had a movie that. I mean, except maybe The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Where that wasn't really that great. I mean, at least as far as I understood it. So, but I don't know, maybe it's worth a rewatch because apparently it could be good.
I liked it.
I did too.
I liked it because that was like the first thing that I like. Because Rooney Mara was in The Social Network, but she wasn't. Mm-hmm. She wasn't really great in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing she really like stuck out to me, and that was the first time I had seen Daniel Craig in something other than James Bond. And so for me, it was like, oh, he's a really good actor. I mean, he was great in James Bond, but still, like, yeah. And so and then I think the story is good. If you hadn't read the book, the story is really good, and mm-hmm. I like that. But
okay, yeah, I haven't even read the books or anything.
Visually, it's great. Visually, well, I think that one.
I was going to say, from a directorial standpoint, like I think I really like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah,
but there were some parts of it that. I mean, made it far from one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's like a great film that everyone should see. I'm simply, yeah.
I'm saying that in general, David Fincher tends not to make duds.
Yeah.
And even if he does make something that's not the best film in the world, like his style is incredible and he's incredibly thoughtful about almost every shot he takes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's engaging to watch. I think he's a great visual storyteller. Mm-hmm. So so this kind of kicks off that culturally. Not only that, but, you know, we have this wasn't like Helena Bonham Carter's like first movie, but this basically is the beginning of her being in tons of things.
And being the crazy chick in everything.
Yes, and being the crazy chick in like everything.
It's like, hey, Bellatrix Lestrange. Hey, what was the name of the character in the Fleet Street one? The guy's like, it was Johnny Depp and her.
That's like every movie that she's in now.
Yeah.
Is it a Tim Burton movie?
No, it was a play that they made into a movie.
Wait, Sweeney Todd?
Sweeney Todd, yeah, she was in that, and she was like the crazy, she's like the crazy lady in everything.
Yeah, she's like an Alice in Wonderland, and she's crazy lady in everything.
Yeah.
So like this kicks off like basically her career as being the crazy lady in every Tim Burton movie, understandably, because I guess her and Tim Burton have some kind of weird thing. I'm not sure why, but that's them.
Hey, Tim's a crazy guy.
And most importantly, and this is another great thing that Josh sent to us, it talks about how in this movie, Brad Pitt kind of redefined the action hero.
like suddenly they're not Schwarzenegger and Stallone anymore. They mm-hmm. they become like this, just super cut, like normal dude. They don't have to be like these overbound muscle guys like carrying big guns. They can just be more semi-normal guys. And from Brad Pitt's point of view, I mean, the movie he makes before Fight Club is Meet Joe Black. And so I feel like when in Meet Joe Black, Brad Pitt gets hit by like three cars, it's like the symbolic death of his like doe-eyed, like lover boy, like kind of ignorant, like oftentimes. I mean, because like lots of like he would be a cop in movies, but he'd always be like the. Like I said, the doe-eyed, yeah. things will always work
he,
out.
He would be the, he was the young actor who was playing like the young, naive character in a lot yeah. of movies. Yeah.
And from Fight Club on?
He's the opposite of that. I mean, now he's like the old man on set. Like, yeah. he's the guy doing like the, like, I mean, in talk about 12 Years a Slave, like he's like the stable, like forward-thinking character in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, just think, like he went from Fight Club, and I mean, he went from that to Snatch. Where, mm-hmm. you know, he's the shirtless, you know, like, Fists of Fury boxer, you yeah. know, the pikey. And, you know, then he goes to being in Ocean's 11.
This is, and, I mean, and he turns it, I mean, he's a comedic actor. I mean, he's great at comedy yeah. now.
yeah. I don't know. Well, and, yeah, all his roles are so different. Like, he, yeah. he basically, like, he hit Fight Club and it was like this never-ending branch mm-hmm. of all these roles that he's done. And some of them are obviously going to have similarities, but, like, I feel like he's been all over the board.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, so like I said, from a cultural impact standpoint, like this movie, people can like look back at a point in time, they can put their finger on this movie and see how it turned the tide for lots of things. Yeah. Now, this is very similar to like, if we were to talk about The Matrix and how people like film action movies. Or,
which were actually came out in the same year.
Which came out in the same year. So, I mean, like I said, 1999
was the was year a, for
was
film.
A great year.
It's like it the best year, year movies almost ever.
Yeah. yeah. So,
everybody was freaking out about the millennium, and they're like, we got to get everything out just in case the world ends after this. Like, all the companies are like, let's get it. Push it out. Push it out. Push it out.
Shove all the good stuff out before everything goes to crap.
Yeah. That's right. I got this great idea. You're going to put
beautiful. Money, just go with it.
Just go. Go. Money, 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 money. Oh, man. So, okay. So, when we talk about the movie itself, though, we will start like we typically do. With the ultimate question, which I think we could all answer pretty easily, but more than just did you enjoy the movie or do you enjoy the movie, do you love the movie, why? Like, what is it about this movie that makes it worth us revisiting? And, Josh, you're on Skype. You get to go first.
I'm on Skype. You're not on Skype?
Well, me and Griffin are in the room. We're high-fiving every time we sure. say something awesome. High five. You know, but I mean, I'm having to give you digital high fives.
Oh, sure.
So
you can give me digital money if you want.
Yeah, I don't have digital or paper.
Man,
money.
Why? Where do you even start when you get asked the question, "Why do you like the movie Fight Club?" I mean, my goodness. Oh, well I mean, what?
Well, I was gonna say, and to you know, to narrow it down, this isn't like what's your favorite part of the movie? Because, like no. I said, well, like we always do, we'll do that at the end, but like. We know we all love this movie. That's why we're on this one. That's not only why we're on it. That's why we're talking about a movie that's like almost 15 years old. Mm-hmm. Old. Like, what does this movie do for you that makes you want to revisit it over and over again?
Oh, man. I mean, first of all, it's just nostalgic, first of all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like you said, it's a cultural moment, and you got to be a part of that cultural moment where it seemed like, you know, between that and like The Matrix, it was like the game completely changed on how movies were made and I mean how they were presented, action movies especially changed a ton. But I think the biggest thing is that every time I go back and revisit this movie, and I've seen this movie so many times over the course of the 15 years that the movie's been out, that every time I go back, there's something that catches my eye again or something that catches my ear that makes me think and makes me think really deeply about the movie. It's not, and it's not only just entertaining, but it's an extremely thoughtful movie at the same time. I mean, where do you even start? From like the millions of, you know, just any speech that Brad Pitt is giving, like his soapbox moments, you know, it's just like,
that's funny,
man.
Yeah, that's very funny.
just anything from like his, you know, where they all singing, all dancing crap of the world, to him on, you know, speaking to, what scene is it? It's the scene where he's giving him the chemical burn, you know, and they're screaming at each other about, you know, our model of God is based off of our fathers, and all of our fathers abandoned us. Like, what does that say about God? And it's like, man, this movie is doing so much more than like most movies even try to mm-hmm. aspire to be. Yeah. And it did it like 100 times over in this movie. It just blows every category of what a movie should be. And I mean, it's a real shame that the movie didn't make a lot of money, but it's certainly a
I think it's done well in its point. Yeah, I think it's done well in since then. Like,
oh,
I
yeah.
think when you talk For about sure. when you talk about once it hit the stores and once it became like a cultural, I mean, I don't think there's very few people who you could say, have you seen this movie or heard of this movie? They're going to say yes. You know, there are very few people who aren't going to say that, who aren't going to say that they've heard of this movie, if not having seen it before. And it just, it's one of those movies that I can't agree more that, like, it makes you think about it and think about movies in ways that you didn't know. Like, before this, you didn't know you were supposed to think about movies in that way. Like, mm-hmm. the only movies you actually thought you should think about in that way were, like, really classic movies. And it was just, yeah, I think that it changed the way we looked at Easter eggs in movies. It like changed the way we thought about like the depths to which like I, you know, oh, these scripts and movies can be important and have important moments and say important things and speak about really big things in the world, and that's okay. Like these yeah. can be more, these can be art and not just a movie. Like it can be literal art. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and in one of the interviews that we read leading up to this, Edward Norton even points that out. They kind of ask, is it too easy, and I'm paraphrasing, like, is it too easy to, or for people to basically take this movie and put it in a silo that says, just go out and vandalize things and destroy things, and it'll make you feel like a man.
Yeah.
And he's like, sure, you can, I guess you can get that from it. Kind of like you can watch lots of movies that deal with really tough things and you can take them at a very surfacey level. He's like, but this is art, and art at its best is usually critiquing society mm-hmm. And yeah. critiquing culture. And like I said, this is a paraphrase. I'm going to actually make sure we link those interviews and stuff in the show notes so you guys can go read that. It's some of the most self-aware artists making this movie. Mm-hmm. Like David Fincher and Brad Pitt and Edward Norton knew exactly what was going on with this work from Chuck Palahniuk.
Yeah.
Like they knew exactly what it was addressing. They knew it was talking about consumerism and like the mundaneness of life. They knew it was like dudes not being able to express their emotions, discontent with like the lie of the American dream. I mean, they all got it, and mm-hmm. it. I think it really showed.
Yeah, it's so awesome. If you get to read and like see, you get to read the interviews and like see some of the interviews and the videos, some of the links that I sent out. It's just amazing. I love the fact that like, the mainstream press at that time just it seemed to fly over their heads what the movie was actually about. And there was just this baffling, shocking nature to the film that they're all like, isn't this going to cause lots of violence? And Edward yeah. Norton, I remember there's one interview where it really looks like Brad Pitt is giving the most like knowing, like sarcastic smirk ever while he's answering these questions. Kind of like, this is going all over your heads, guys. Like you're doing the normal movie questions and I just know what this movie's supposed to do and you have no idea what this movie's supposed to be doing. And I just love the fact that yet you're t- they were self-aware. They knew what they were doing in this movie, and I mean, it ended up being a cultural milestone from a movie making standpoint.
Very much so. I was actually telling Griffin and Laura because when we were watching Fight Club earlier, that there, like, one of the interviews with Ed Norton specifically, I almost want to just have the interview with Ed Norton out there and do a podcast on just what he says, because just his bits of information from his time with Fight Club and what Fight Club is supposed to be are so, like I said, self-aware. Like, he knew exactly what they were talking about, and he knew exactly how it should affect culture. And so I get to bore everyone with one of his longer ones, because I couldn't not share this. Because you have to think, like, this is Edward Norton. Edward, you know, lots of actors, they take jobs, they try to get in some kind of character, but they don't really understand, like, what the bigger movie is saying. I mean, some do, you know. You've got your Daniel Day-Lewis's who transcend acting, you know, but, like, for the most part...
Basically, he shows up and you win Academies.
Exactly. So Edward Norton says, in regards to, like, how Fight Club is different than the normal film, he says... I guess I felt for a long time that a lot of films that were aimed at my generation were some baby boomer perception of what Gen X was about. They seemed to be tailored to a kind of reductive image of us as slackers and to have a banal, glib, low-energy, angst-ridden realism, none of which I or anyone I know relates to. They didn't speak to the deeper and darker underlying sense of despair and paralysis and numbness in the face of overwhelming onslaught of media information that we received from the cradle. And so he just goes on this tirade. He beautifully expounds what most films are. You know, they depict, you know, Generation X, whatever. I mean, just like now, people are talking about Generation Y being, like, lazy or, you know, self-entitlement. And they never really, they address, like, the results, but they don't address, like, why we're like this. And Fight Club does.
Yeah.
Which is, like I said, which is why Fight Club, to me, sticks out. I mean, like, you can't have Tyler Durden on scene for more than about 10 seconds without him dropping some kind of anti-consumerism or, you know, life's going to end, you're not the things you own. Or what does he say? The things you own end up owning you. Mm-hmm. Like, it's dropping this almost,
which I think
Nietzsche philosophy.
Yeah, you have to realize that. I think we talk about people. You hear people say those things now, and it wasn't like tons of people had said them before that.
Exactly.
Very few people had said them before that. I mean, that's what we often forget when we talk about older films and older art. We're like, oh yeah, that's totally overdone. It's like, no. They were doing it first. Like, they were talking about these things very early before. Like, before this was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's where to realize, like, the impact of this movie is to look at and say, these things weren't being talked about, at least not in, like, popular media culture. They may have been talked about in philosophy and, you know, but not in popular media culture at that point.
Well, and I'll tell you, for me personally, every time I watch this movie, it's a reminder of why I have this philosophy right now that I can't stand what the narrator, what Edward Norton's character calls single serving conversations. Mm-hmm. I'm highly extroverted. I will talk to just about anybody, but I cannot stand having the, hey, what do you do? You know what? And then, like, as soon as you answer these three or four questions that ever, you know, where are you from? What do you do? You know, cool. How That's do you it. Know? So-and-so, you know,
yeah.
Like the,
right.
these very, oh, these terrible to me, these death conversations. It reminds me when he's, when Tyler Durden says, you are not your job. You are not your bank account. But I feel like every time someone asks me that question, they're basically trying to decide who I am based on my
job and your bank account.
And thus my bank account. and so, like, I've got to the point now where I basically refuse to answer those questions, and I never will ask. Because I don't think that tells me anything about the person.
Hmm.
In most cases. So if someone asks me, what do you do? I say, what do I say? I say, ninja assassin. I say, I'm a ninja assassin. And they go, ha, 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 ha. And then I usually say, so, if you could do anything,
you know, and not worry about getting paid for it. Like, what are you passionate about? Mm-hmm. And some people are like, hey, I do this thing for my job, and I happen to be passionate about it. But I find that's rare.
Yeah.
You know?
There's some people who really love what they do in their work. Like, I know plenty of people who really love what they do, and that is their passion. They're, you know, some people are something as obvious as, like, they're a social worker or a counselor. And then mm-hmm. some people are like, I'm a businessman, and I really like doing mm-hmm. this. I like doing these things. But I think it's more often nowadays that, like, what you do 9 to 5 is not what you care about. It's just what you get paid for. And so I think that that's something where it's so funny that he uses that metaphor of, like, you're a guy on an airplane all the time, so you're used to having these relationships that last for an hour or two. So you're used to these things, and so you just see all of these things as just single serving, as just worthwhile for about an hour, maybe two. You can get a little bit of a conversation out of it, and you're off. Which makes it so interesting to me that, like, he meets this alter ego within himself on a plane in one of those single serving moments. Mm-hmm. And I think he throws that relationship away in that moment of, like, this single serving thing, I'll probably never talk to you again. And it turns out that not only is this person going to be integral in his life, this person is him. Which is, like, really, I think, just, like, the even deeper thing is that this person is him.
Which shows that deep inside, he has these longings.
Yeah.
To break this cycle.
To not be working for the man.
Exactly. I mean, like, even Tyler, being the narrator, like, says, like, you know, advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy stuff we don't need. You know, like, this endless cycle of, like, the false American dream. And there is something freeing. Oh, God, what else does he say? You know, you have to hit rock bottom. It's only when we've lost everything that we're free to do anything. Mm. And there's so much, like, it all sounds so good. Because to a certain degree, like, it's true.
Yeah.
No, go ahead, John.
I was going to say that it is true, but I think that Edward Norton and Pitt and Fincher were self-aware to the fact that, like, what they were doing was not espousing sort of, like, a countercultural reality, but they were almost, to a certain extent, after a certain point in the movie, satiring the response to consumerism.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, because it, I mean, they're definitely, you know, there's the moment where, at the point in the movie where, spoiler alert, Norton realizes that he's just, you know, Pitt is, or this Tyler Durden is just a creation of his own mind, and he bucks against it because it's gone too far mm-hmm. for him. And, you know, that they knew when they were making this movie. And, I mean, I think the movie makes it clear as a message. I mean, granted, you've just been espoused the anti-consumerism, you know, the, we're the middle children of history, you know, the great our great war is a spiritual war, our great depression is our lives. Yeah, you know, kind of all that.
So many quotable lines.
I know, it's so awesome. But you've gotten that for almost 2 hours of the movie, well, like an hour and a half of the movie, and then it sort of switches to the point where it's like, all right, well, now we're showing you this response has gone too far. As far as it goes.
So at what point do you feel like it switches? Like, what point do you see it switching in the movie? And I'm not asking because I feel like there's a right answer. I'm just wondering where you feel like...
Where the movie switches or where our theology would switch from Tyler's?
I think both places. I think the point where we realize, like, that not only... that we realize is Tyler is going too far. And also the point where, I mean, because I'm not talking about the point where he realizes that Tyler is him in a construct, because we know that that's an obvious switch. But I think realize where Tyler has gone too far, and also realize where our theology switches in the movie.
I'm trying to think. I think that it would be, I would say that when Bob dies... he comes back, you know, and his head's blown off or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, there's that great part in the movie where they all start chanting, his name is Robert Paulson.
Yeah.
And you know,
Robert Paulson. Yeah.
I remember when we were friends. I think like one of our animal, like a gerbil or hamster, died, and we all stood around it and chanted at the hamster.
Wow.
It was caught up in the moment of the fact that that movie was awesome. But I think that's the real point of the movie, because I think that's his life before Tyler kind of took over his psyche, and he comes back and is sort of jarred back to reality to a certain extent, because, you know, Bob, somebody that he knew when he was spending his time slumming around, you know, support groups, he really sees that this is going too far and these people are brainwashed beyond like what I think is normal.
Because
that's kind of when Project Mayhem takes its
yeah,
turn.
That's whenever basically Tyler starts shutting him out and he doesn't know the same things that Tyler knows.
Yeah.
That's where the switch happens, that like he walks in on things, he's like, what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, and it's such an interesting, I mean, gosh.
So what I think happens is at some point in the movie, the narrator, Edward Norton, goes from being completely fine with having no moral compass, like the what do they call it? Like the might is right, you know, like whatever I want to do is the best thing to do because I'm all there is. Like that seems good, but kind of like you talk about, like once someone dies, he realizes that it's not necessarily bad to have some structure,
mm-mm,
to have a framework to work out of, to have a moral,
to have boundaries.
Moral objectivity, to be like some things are right and some things are wrong. And that's when he starts pushing against Tyler, and Tyler keeps pushing back, saying, none of this matters. Like, you're basically caging yourself.
And I think at the same time, though, for me, I hear that and I'm like, there is a lot of this that isn't, like, I'm not, I think that in one hand, on one hand, Tyler is like at that point crazy in the movie, like, mm-hmm, he's gone way too far. I think that on the other hand, he still makes a really good point that like very little of this matters.
Yeah,
that very little of this, like, eternally has any value. Like, and maybe,
and to that degree, he's completely right.
Yeah, and I think, and so I think whenever I think about that, I mean, that's just where, I mean, right before we got on the podcast, Mike and I were talking, because, you know, just going through, I think I'm going through a lot of the same frustrations, mm-hmm, and I think we all are in some very real capacity, where we're all saying, like, there's that point in the movie where he's like, Tyler's with him, and I think, is it on the plane that they have this conversation? Where he says like, I asked my dad what I should do, and he told me to go to college. And so I finished college, and I called him, and I was like, what should I do next? He's like, get a job. And then I got a job, and I called him, and I said, what do I do next? And he said, get married. And then he says this line, and he's like, we were a generation raised by women, so why would adding another woman to that make it any better? Which I think is, on one hand, like, really cynical about marriage, and I'm not advocating for that, but I am advocating for this idea that, like, you do this, then this, then this, then this, then this, because that's what your parents maybe did before you, or, you know, whatever happened. And that's the way you live. Like, this is the life you should be living. And if you don't achieve that, then you get depressed about it because you don't have a wife in mind.
Well, you're told that's where you'll find life.
Exactly. You're told that, like, you figure this out, if you can get to college and get a job, you'll be good. And you get those things and you're like, okay, now if you can get married, you'll be good. And then after you get that, you're like, okay, now if you have kids, that'll make it better. Because we go through this life assuming that the next thing is going to make it better. And it's not like it's consumeristic in a really, like, in like a lot of really healthy ways. Like, having children is great and being married is great. And I'm not saying that it's not, even though I don't have either one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still consumeristic to buy into that as though, for some reason, that's going to fix it. For some reason, marriage, even with, like, a fantastic person, is going to somehow fix the gaping wound that is your soul. Like, is going to somehow fix this gaping hole in you that's crying out for something different. Mm-hmm. So, that's my soapbox. Yeah.
Can we always acknowledge that using the word soapbox during this is a pun?
Well, I mean, it's an intentional pun.
You had the inaugural, so you get most of the credit.
Yeah, you get all the credit at this point.
So, yes. Well, and that's what happens. So anything in life, we can make an idol.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like from a Christian theological standpoint, we hear this all the time, but it never really rings home. You know, we never really put words to that discontent. We just hear sermons that say, don't make anything an idol except for God. You know, don't put your life in this, don't put your life in that. But then we walk right out of church, or we turn the podcast off of our favorite sermon person.
Yeah.
And we go back to our job, like, again, to, you know, that we hate, so we can buy stuff we don't need. You know, like, we basically, like, I need to get this job so I can buy more podcasts of my favorite, you know, pastor, or, you know, something like that. Like, it's just, we instantly plug right back in so easily that we don't even realize we're doing it. Mm-hmm. Like I said, which is why, you know, I think it's easy for us to resonate at least with the first part of Tyler Durden's plan, and it's waking up and hitting bottom.
Yeah. Well, it's like Edward Norton, like, you know, his character, the narrator in the movie, you know, he's getting all this stuff, like the IKEA stuff. You know, I love that, the visual scene of that, you know, the catalog
rings up
sort of
everything, and it's all new, brand new,
it
lowest
rings
price.
It up and puts it in his, and it's just like, you know, like it wasn't even, he didn't love the stuff. It wasn't like in the way that, like, I really like this computer because I can do this or this or this on it. It was like, I love the fact that it gives me this sort of like status. And it gives me all of this, these good feelings that I have all this really great stuff that matches and is from IKEA. And I that totally makes sense, because I see that progression. Because I think, you know, you were talking about, you get married and then you have kids and it'll make it better. Then the next step, like, the pressure that you feel once you have kids is you got to get a bigger house and you got to get a nice house.
And you have to decorate it appropriately. And it has to be a good balance of vintage and new and modern. It's like, and it's just – we continually perpetrate
it. Because you have to ask yourself, what kind of dining set defines me as a person?
Exactly. And I think that's that, like, that statement in of itself is like, because he talks about, he's like, I have all the sets. I have even the one with the bubbles in it so that you know it was handcrafted. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what have I done?
Exactly. Because so owning a home, okay? Well, the bank owns my home, but pretending to own my own home. All right. So, like, when I go to other people's houses, I say, well, that's not how I would have done it.
Yeah.
You know, or I can see that they're trying to tell us that, you know, by decorating this way. Like, you know, you go into certain people's houses and they have, like, shelves full of things that, you know, they never use, but they look nice, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, these books are all used.
He says as he has four shelves of books behind him, but he's read most of them.
Well, I haven't. My wife has.
Your wife
My
has.
Wife is much smarter.
Someone
than
in
I
the
am.
House has read most of them.
So, but that's the thing. Like, when you walk into this room, you know, we painted it a dark color. Like, I have my musical instruments on the wall. I have some of my drawings on the wall, and we have books. So, and a cool TV entertainment center over
it's
here.
It's like, look, so, I'm an artist.
Yeah, when you walk in, you say, man, he's a musician and an artist, and he's so well-read, and he's obviously really into very good movies, because look at those DVDs. I think the only one over there that he would be ashamed of is Bend It Like Beckham. So,
and you're not even really ashamed of that one.
Oh, I'm totally ashamed of it, but it's not mine. So there's things that happen when you get married that merge. But so, you know, like, you know, and that's why it's hard for me to have self analyzing, okay? So when I watch a movie like Fight Club, I do this. I say, why is it that I still want to buy Blu-rays of everything? Even though, like, I'm an IT guy and I could have everything in digital format. I can watch it on any of my devices and I can have it anywhere and it'll be so convenient. It's because when people walk into my house, I want them to see a shelf of all the things that I think is amazing or are amazing. And they go, wow. I also like Battlestar Galactica.
Because it's funny because we think that somehow our book collection is going to define us. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think that, man, in a lot of ways, it really defines us as people who are yearning for more approval. That's really all it defines us as. It's like, here, look at my movie. And I'm the same way. When you walk into my, I have a room in a house. I live with another couple, and I'm not married. So I said another couple, like I was, and I live by myself. And with, anyways, and when you walk into my room, it's like walk-in bookshelf, and it's like comics and DVDs, and you know, oh, this guy's really into he's well-read.
You go, wow, this guy is definitely single.
This guy is clearly single because nobody's gotten rid of all those comics yet.
Unless you marry a really awesome woman who's into comics, then you have your comics just waiting to be displayed.
Oh, yeah.
So, just saying. Plug for awesome marriage. Anyway.
So, Josh, what do you display in your house?
I'm gonna say, what is it?
An excellent comic book-loving wife who can find... Yeah, well, that's kind of funny because, like, I come from the pastoring world. Like, I'm a church planner. And so it's like, immediately when you guys say that, I think of, like, in that world, like, pastors take, like pictures of their bookshelves and are like, look at what I did with my bookshelf today and all that other stuff. And because it totally does. Like, it defines with the books. And then people write in the comments, like, oh, I see you've got this book. I can tell everything about you from that.
You read Tozer? Wow.
What a great commentary. I read that in seminary.
And that's totally what happens. But, you know, that's totally what it is. I mean, what's the first thing that you see when you walk in the front door is the bookshelf. And it's got the movies. And then shamefully on the second shelf is all the kids' movies, which are obscured by knickknacks and stuff. So people really can't see what's there.
Because for some reason you're ashamed of your kids' stuff, which is so interesting. It's like,
well, you know, there's only so much. Like, I can only make the kids like certain things, like the Lego movie and other such movies like that. That I also include
on your shelf?
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, I can't really explain Barbie, the princess, and the pop star to other people.
You're a bad parent.
Yeah.
That's what I would walk in your house and I would immediately be like, well, Josh doesn't love his children because he's teaching them about Barbie.
Yeah.
And as we know, society has taught us how wrong Barbie is. So I'm right and Josh is wrong.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of... it's totally true. As much as we want to buck against that, as much as we want to be the people who ascribe to what Fight Club is laying down in the movie, you know, then we're all part of the generation of hipsters that, you know, buy vinyl and it sounds so much better on vinyl. And
I just
all
take
these
my
other
record
things.
Player with me all the time. In my car, my record player's with me.
I just have it strapped to a backpack on my back, and I just carry it around, and I don't bother with an iPod. But, yeah, man, we haven't really had that luxury too much because having four kids really straps you to the cash, so you don't really got a lot of opportunity to ever really get anything that can sort of define you. But
yeah, but that's not, but see, and that's the thing. I think when we make things like we have, for example purposes, almost sermon examples, we forget that there's tons of ways to do this because, you know, when you have kids, that's why like having a mommy blog is like one of the like biggest things in the world right now, because then you can be like, oh, well, we're breastfeeders in public. Oh, you don't breastfeed in public. Oh, well, this is natural, so I'm right. Or, hey, well, we use cloth diapers. Well, we use real diaper. You know, like there's so many ways that even doing the most basic thing in your day, you can find your identity and you can basically plant your flag there. And
for
say,
sure.
I mean, heck, I drive this way to work, but whenever this other person goes from basically the same neighborhood, they go this other way. And my way is totally better because I know I have more left turns, but really there's no one on this route. So it's faster because I always get the green left turns.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're basically everything's a competition and you're always just trying to get a little bit ahead. And like I said, I think this is why we all connect, or most people, especially I think guys. It's not because of the violence in this movie that the guys connect to it. It's because we're told so often that these things are going to give us life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of pressure on guys in society to, you know, be the breadwinner, to be successful, to make lots of money, to, you know, to be the handsomest, best sports ball player, most virile, I don't know, shrewdest manager of money, you know, just like everything. Like, there's so much pressure. And, you know, and like I said, it's not just guys. There's pressure on everybody to be beautiful or to be successful in whatever field. But there's so much pressure, especially on guys, to do this, that we just long for this Tyler Durden to come along and say, you're not your job. You know, you're not your bank account. And to remind us that, like, it's only when you've lost everything that we're free to do anything. Because he takes us to where we need to get. And that's why I honestly believe that's why we resonate with his message. Mm-hmm. The problem is that he takes his message and takes it to its logical conclusion, which is, at the end of the day, we're all that matters. So, you know, Griffin is discontent with his life. Griffin, tell everyone to screw off.
Yeah.
All right? Because Griffin's the only person that you need to make happy. And as long as Griffin's happy, you know, Griffin's happy.
Yeah. And
that's not the way the world works.
Yeah. It's this me-centric, this, like, I am my own religion. I am my own God. I am my own, like, answer for everything idea.
Well, it goes back to a quote, and this used to be, when I first watched this movie, I was not a Christian. So one of the things that I carried as a flag was the quote the full quote of what Josh mentioned earlier, when Tyler Durden says, like, fathers model God to their kids. If our fathers failed, what does that tell us about God? He doesn't like you, and he doesn't care about you. Mm-hmm. And I was like, boom, you know, that's why God is dumb.
Yeah.
You know, stop. I mean, and honestly, not that my dad was the worst dad in the entire world, but honestly, if my dad was the picture of God, then I was like, I don't understand God as God the Father. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, you know, later down the road in college, I started really exploring, like, these concepts, the theology behind it, and realizing that, you know, well, you know, God is a model, or our fathers are a model for God, but they're an incredibly imperfect model of God. So imagine all the things that you wish you had from your father. Like, that's what God is.
Yeah, like, they're still made out of clay, but they don't, they're probably just like a ball of clay. Mm-hmm. Like, they're made out of the same thing in some ways, but, like, they're not,
yeah.
It's not what you should be like, all right, if I just recreate this is, okay, God, got it.
Well, it's like everything else that, like I said, we try to find life in. Almost anything can be good, mm-hmm. but it can't be eternal, you know? It can't be the pinnacle, you know? Having money is not a bad thing, but hoping that having a lot of money will make you happy is not, it's not the pinnacle. You know, having a job you love is great, but it's not the pinnacle. Like, having a great marriage is great, but it's not the pinnacle. I mean, much like you were saying before, Griffin, you know, it's like these things. We always want just a little bit more.
Yeah.
And until we find something that truly satisfies the longing that we have, the thing that's making us discontent in our consumeristic striving for a false American dream culture, until we find whatever that is, we're going to continue to be discontent.
Yeah, because it's incredibly clear that we want approval. It's clear in all these things, mm-hmm. in finding the perfect marriage, and finding the perfect job, and in putting on this image of the perfect house with the perfect, all the perfect things in their perfect places. We want approval in that. And so we continue to look for it in things that are going to continually, that don't,
they're going to let us down.
They're going to let us down because they don't see what we see as perfect. Like, they, if I found someone who thought all the things that I put on my shelf were the best things, that would be great. But there's no one like that. There's no one who would walk into my house and see all the things in my room and be like, oh, everything in here is the best thing.
It's ever. The best thing. Well, okay. So I feel like we're getting about to that point in the show. And I don't necessarily want us to go down a totally new rabbit trail. So I want to kind of start winding it down. Acknowledging, and we might hit on this a couple more things in the moments and maybe our final thoughts. But I do want to kind of progress to that. Like I said, acknowledging to the listeners out there that Fight Club is so profound at times that there is literally a ton to talk about. Like, I'm not using literally figuratively. I'm using literally. You know, like, this... The reason that I would say we revisit this movie is because there is literally almost something new you can talk about every time you watch this movie, like mm-hmm. Josh talked about. You rewatch this movie, something I didn't see before. You know, you rewatch it again, something you didn't even see before. I mean, heck, my favorite moment that I'm going to talk about a little bit is something that I never noticed until I rewatched this movie. You know, probably like time 13 or 15 or something now. It's the first time I've noticed it. So with that, I'll shift us gradually. And Josh, I'll let you start. But is there anything about this movie that you would consider a come on moment, like, or something you didn't like?
Yeah, I remember I knew this was coming. This question was coming. And so when I watched the movie last week, I was like, because I got to look at this critically, because this movie is just so good that you're deigned to just sort of gloss over anything that could be a come on moment. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking, like, in the midst of all of that, the mayhem leading up to the buildings exploding at the end, like, where it just seems like there was a lot of stuff going on where somebody should have called the police.
But they own the police.
Like, well, they don't completely own them, because there was that one detective that, you know, was mm-hmm. was still there, and it's like they didn't own everything. It just at a certain point, you know, even when they're like they grab Marla off the bus and you know, pull her in there. Where in any of that, at some point, from the point she got on the bus to the point where she got off the bus, where there's somebody like, there's something not right about this whole situation right now. And I was just kind of, that, I mean, if there's going to be a come on moment in this movie, it's going to be that there's a seeming lack of police force at the climax of the movie. But what action movie doesn't do that?
Exactly. So, I would agree with that, but Griffin, what do you have? Could you think of anything?
I could think of something. Why did no one else think it was, like in the group, think it was totally inappropriate that Marla was at the testicular cancer support group? Like, why was nobody else like, you can't be here. You're not allowed to be here.
What are you talking about? She had more right to be there than
yeah,
I know.
Yeah, I was just like, I was like, hold on, no one else is, like, just Edward Norton is upset about, just him? All right.
Yeah, well, and that's the crux of the support groups. You don't really call out anybody. It's just a place to be, you know, to self-help, you know? And I mean, that is another thing that we didn't really even get into, the concept of self-help groups or addict groups, you know? Like, where's that balance between, like, truly helpful to be a part of a community? And sharing and open.
Well, that's where that, I think there's that scene, the scene with the lady who's dying, who's terminal, mm-hmm. and she's like, I have all these things in my house, and I just want one person to have sex. And she's like, oh, and moving on. And so there's that moment where it's like, there is an end to where this is useful.
Yeah.
There's an end to where this, like, self-help idea of, like, if you have stuff wrong, you just need to figure it out with, like, talking to people. There's an end to it.
Yeah. So, like I said, there's that whole avenue that we are not really treading down. So, this is what comments are for. Listener feedback. That's you.
Let's start a really long comment chain about this.
That would be great. I would love to have a really exceptionally long conversation chain about this movie.
Yeah.
So, my come on moment is something I did not think of when I first watched this movie in 1999. Since then, I'm now, I am my job. I'm an IT professional, not kind of unprofessional most of the time, but work in IT. So when I see the grand finale of this movie, I'm like, okay, I know it was 1999, But you're telling me that all these credit card institutions don't have some kind of disaster recovery plan. They don't have, like, an off-site, you know, some other storage where you blow up the building. Like, oh, well, we just recover from, you know, site two. Is disaster recovery something that didn't happen until after 2000? You know, like, it just didn't... It's, you know, it's all too easy. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm like, you can't just blow up four buildings and reset everyone's credit. You know, I think if you could, people would have done it already.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not in a movie way, but like in a real life way,
like
someone who like was up to their, you know, head in credit card debt would have like flipped out and tried to blow up a building where the credit card information was.
Yeah.
If that was such a thing to happen. So it ends up being symbolic, which I think works, but come on.
I'd say maybe that's part of the point. Kind of like if we're really reaching the full end of satirizing the response, you know, that is really, are they in this giant scheme? Did they actually really make it any dent? You know, they blew up a bunch of buildings, but if you think about it to its true end, you know, where we're satirizing this response to consumerism, and you know, where sort of like the nihilistic attitude reaches its limitations, you know, then it's kind of fitting that at the end it's like we blew up a bunch of these buildings with this really complex scheme that we blew it up and the credit card companies all failed. When no, not really.
No.
The credit card companies knew what they were doing. Which is interesting because that's the other come on thing I was thinking of but I didn't go with was this idea that when they blow up the buildings, like nothing happens to the building they're standing in. Like these buildings seemed really close to where they were. Like if you think about it, the post 9/11, and that's crazy the fact that this movie came out then because there's no way they would have been able no way the studios would have allowed them to do this after 2001. You know, blowing up a bunch of major buildings in a major city. There's no way that movie would have happened like that. They would have had to either just scrap it or redo the ending or something.
Or it'd have been futuristic.
Right, exactly. Exactly. They'd have to set it somewhere else or do something else or something like that. But yeah, I mean, that was the other thing is like these buildings all blow up and, you know, we all watched 9/11 happen and a lot of buildings blew up not because like planes ran into them. Like other buildings came down just because of the fact that those buildings came down.
Yeah.
And like, so it's like they're standing in this building while four buildings come around all around them and nothing happens to them at any point. Nor is there really even a lot of dust.
Yeah.
So I thought that was kind of funny.
Well, and see, and this is one of those things, like when a story is told so well, and you're totally on board with the characters and what's going on, and it's got you really engaged in certain aspects of it, like we're nitpicking... movie about a dude who has like a multiple personality disorder, who's got insomnia, who's starting a fight club underground, beating people up, who all these things that are like way out of left field, and like you know we're trying to nitpick these little things
about there not being enough dust,
and it's true, yeah, and
it's true that there isn't enough dust, and that it should have something should have happened.
Yeah, but we're so engrossed, and I think that's a mark. That's another reason why it's David Fincher at his best because we don't care.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So
I mean, really, if somebody brought this up outside of this conversation, I'd be like, "Shut up! This movie's awesome."
Stop it! You cannot tell me one bad thing.
I'll put that on a T-shirt. Shut up! This movie's awesome. Josh Gray.
Name one bad thing about this movie. One bad thing. I'll tell you.
Well, you notice there wasn't enough dust and the explosions at the end of the movie. You shut up! You shut up right now. Josh Gray.
This is a great movie, realworldtheology.com.
So we transition, and I know this might be even harder to narrow down than a come-on moment, because, like we said, this movie is endlessly quotable. It sounds like almost every line in this movie is something that I would repeat when, you know, jockeying quotes back and forth. But, Josh, can you narrow down a favorite moment, or maybe a favorite moment or two?
I don't feel like there's any way that this scene could get brought up in the context of our conversation. So the scene that I'll go with is the scene where they steal the fat from the liposuction clinic. And then just the awesome quote of, like, the irony that they're selling these rich women's,
their,
you know,
their fat butts back to them.
And like, $20
yeah.
Oh, man, and I just love it. You know, they're, like, throwing the bags over, and then one of them breaks on the barbed wire and gets all over them. And,
he's like, I'll grab another one.
You know, and then it's just, like, the scene pretty much ends with that, like, lady at the department store, like, this is the best soap ever.
This is the best soap. Actually, and see, there's so many things that are quotable in this movie that, like, I steal to say other things. Because anytime I think something's the best, like, for example, my lovely wife made chicken pie tonight. And so whenever I tell her it's the best, I never say, like, oh, this is really the best, sweetie. I say, this is the best chicken pie. And I had forgotten that that's why I said it that way.
It's because
I've been saying it for 15 years that way. You know, like, this is the best band. You know, or like, this is the best comic book I've ever read.
This is the best soap ever.
Just with that inflection. Just because it sticks with you. Oh, every line. So meticulous.
Yeah.
So what were you going with just that one, Josh?
Well, I mean, I could go with pretty much almost any scene in the movie.
Because that's fine. That's fine.
All right.
I just want
to. All right. Yeah.
Just want to give you the opportunity.
Yeah. Maybe I'll interrupt one of you when you say something later. Yeah.
That's actually the best policy.
Perfect.
I personally love. So there's two things that I love about. There's two like parts of the movie. The first is the very first scene where you're brought into the movie at the very end of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I love it when people do that, and I like the way that
if they can do it right,
they can do it right. And so he was foreshadowing so much there because in that scene he says, "I know what's happening because Tyler knows what's happening,"
mm-hmm.
and he told you right then, "I am him, he is me," and you miss it completely.
Oh yeah.
And so I like that, but then I also like the scene where I like the scenes where you're being shown all the things from everybody else's perspective of like mm-hmm. what was happening in the parking lot whenever he was fighting himself.
Yeah. Punching himself.
Yeah, and that's why you're like, oh, that's why you're so like he says in that whenever he's like does that thing with his boss. He's like, this oddly reminded me of the first time that I fought with Tyler in that parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's because it's the exact same thing. But yeah, I think those two parts of that scene, like where those kind of two sides of that scene where you're realizing like all the ways that like you're like, it finally starts clicking for you. Like, oh, you're one guy. And I go back to it. I love... I think just because of my experience with this in general, like the whole conversation that they have about where he's like, yeah, I called my dad and asked him what I should do. He tells me to go to college, you know, and that was straight up exactly my experience was like, I literally called my parents and asked my parents like, what should I do? And they were like, you should go to college. And then I remember going home and asked my family, like, what's next? And they were like, get a good job. And then they were like, now you have to get a job with a salary. Or now you have to get a job with benefits.
Then
you have to get a job with a salary. And in all that, it's like, why aren't you getting married? I mean, it's just a laundry list of things that we're supposed to be doing to somehow achieve what they have. And for me, I'm like, I don't really like what you have, so why would I do what, like, I, yeah. And so it's just this very interesting, I think, just in culture, just how we perpetuate this idea of, if you do these things, you will be happy, and you will make it, and you'll, mm-hmm. you'll get to the end of your life and be as sad and depressed about your life as we are. And that's what we're told is like by people who are like the advertisers are just as sad and depressed as everyone mm-hmm. else. Like they're no different. But still they perpetuate this idea that like, if you do all these things, you'll be happier.
Well, and what I liked was the first part you were talking about is that like this movie or at the heart of what you're talking about is that this movie has high replay value.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, I wonder if this came out before The Sixth Sense. Just checked, also 1999.
Wow.
Ridiculous.
So Sixth Sense came out in 1999 as well. Like, what were we doing in 1999? Did we ever leave the theater?
We were all just like, oh my gosh! Oh my gosh! 1999 was like the year of the big twist.
Apparently it was. And so, but, and that's the thing. I think The Sixth Sense rewards you for watching the movie a second time.
Yeah.
But I think Fight Club is one of, I probably, oh man, I'd have to make like a top five list. This might make like a top five Tuesday or something. Like the top five, like, most rewatchable movies.
Yeah.
Mm. Or rewardingly rewatchable. Because I think Fight Club would easily make a top five list, if not the number one spot for, like, movie that rewards you for rewatching it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because you keep enjoying it, but, like, you see something new. Like, I remember watching The Princess Bride over and over, and, like, catching some of Fezzik's lines that I never caught in the first couple times, or seeing these little things. But Fight Club, like I said, 15 years later, having seen this movie probably 15 times, still catching stuff.
Hmm.
I love that. So, you know, not a specific moment, but, you know, a favorite concept of the movie. And I think watching it this time, my current favorite moment is the thing that I caught this time that I'd never really noticed before. And I think it's probably because the age I'm at now. Kind of like I never really understood the IKEA joke when I was, like, in high school. Because I had no reason.
Shop at IKEA. Yeah, didn't shop at there IKEA. Wasn't IKEA around here to shop at.
Yeah, and there wasn't IKEA. But, you know, now being older, I get the IKEA joke so much more, having been to IKEA and, like, lusted over everything in IKEA.
And the best part is, like, where he's like trying the thing in that he's trying to give them money, and we're trying to give them money, and they're putting us on hold.
That's right.
Like, we're trying to give you money, and you're putting me on hold. And she's like, please hold. He's like, I've been holding.
So there's things like that I've noticed, but the thing right now, at the life stage that I'm in, one of the reasons I love doing real world theology is because we almost always have conversations that have weight, have substance. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, especially as a guy, I'm taught by everything around me to have those single serving conversations. Like I said, I will be rude to another guy before I have a single serving conversation with him. Because through my late college years and now, like I said, much past that, I have found that it is incredibly rewarding to have honest, substantial conversations with other guys that extend past sports, or our favorite TV show, or, you know, what we did that day. And I realized in this movie there's a scene when apparently Edward Norton blows up his own house, but, you know, we don't know why. And so he calls up Tyler, and they have a beer, and Tyler starts spouting off some of his, like, you know, why do we know what a whatever is. A duvet is.
Oh yeah, because he's like, you know, he's like, what's a duvet? He's like, it's a bed, or it's a bedspread. And he's like, it's a blanket. It's a blanket. He's like, why does a guy know what a duvet is?
You know, so they leave the bar. They've had some beers, and Ed Norton's just basically like, well, thanks so much for having a beer with me. I guess I'll go get a hotel. Yeah. And he's like,
just ask,
man. He's like, what are you talking about? He's like, three pitchers of beer and you still can't ask. And he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, you called me because you needed a place to stay. He's like, no. He's like, just ask.
Yeah.
And I'm like, this is every guy conversation that I used to have. Yeah. You know, because he keeps going like, oh, I could stay. Would that be a problem? And he goes, would it be a problem for you to ask?
Would it be a problem for you to ask? And he's like, well, can I stay with you? Come on.
Yeah, come on. I mean, like there's so much like either pride or lack of understanding about how two dudes can communicate that, like, that it shouldn't have taken that long, but to me it was this huge, like I said, in the life stage I'm in now, hilarious scene of watching, like, a guy who is, like, very honest,
who has a legitimate need,
who has a need, he won't come out and say it.
Yeah.
And the other guy is just very blunt, and, like, I'm like, I am Tyler Durden when I talk to dudes now. I'm like, look, let's stop pretending. Let's stop thinking that, like, your life is perfect and you're completely happy. Let's just, you know, cut this, you know, What do you do for a living? Tell me something about yourself. Be honest with me. You know, let's skip this stuff. And like I said, for the longest time, that's all I had. All my best friends from high school, like, we would almost never know anything about each other because we were basically taught that we talked about video games, you know, we talked about sports, and we just never talked about, like, what really mattered to us. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't realize how deprived I was of that, like I said, until I got to the stage of life I'm in now. And seeing that on screen, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a perfect example of what I see almost every... That's what I see at work almost every day, watching other people interact. Just this people who are unwilling or don't know how to communicate with one another, honestly. Mm-hmm. And just realizing what they're lacking. So that's probably my, like I said, that's why I call it my current favorite moment, because I could probably watch this movie again and I'll probably end up catching something else and it'll be my favorite moment. But that more or less wraps us up. So we take one final chance. So Josh, final thoughts about this movie. What would you commend to people?
Oh man. I am Jack's elated movie viewing. This movie is absolutely incredible. I mean, what else do you say? I feel like you ended it on just the perfect note about what the movie is really all about, is thinking deeper and talking to people, actually knowing people. And that, I mean, I think even though the philosophy of this movie is not necessarily the most Christian thing in the entire world, this movie gets you talking about real life and gets you talking about just what life is and maybe a picture of what it should be like in our current culture, because I don't think much has changed. It's just gotten more interconnected and more mm-hmm. social since 1999, or since the book came out. But I try to always tell people with these kind of movies, like, if you haven't seen this movie, you have got to see this movie.
We've got to have coffee over it, talk about it. Like,
exactly. Don't just watch it, but think about it or talk to someone else about it. Like that, mm-hmm. I think that's what the beauty was of the fact that, like, I grew up with this movie, like, with all of my high school friends, because I think it really did get us talking, and it was a movie that you experienced with other people. It wasn't just a movie that I think the time I watched it previous is the first time I've ever watched this movie by myself.
Hmm.
And it was a more analytical experience, but it definitely was one of those experiences where I was like, I really want to talk to someone about this movie. And I had to wait a whole week to do it.
Well, no, definitely. Because as soon as Griffin came in, we chatted for a little bit and then we started talking about this movie as if we were already recording. Well, and I was like, whoa, whoa. Right.
And we were talking about, like, deeper. And that's the thing about this is, like, this movie for me speaks to so much of, like, I want to preface this with saying, like, I, once again, like what you said, Josh, is that this isn't like a Christian theme movie. So I'm not saying, like, that this is like the story of my life,
mm-hmm.
but, like, the things that this movie talks about and really puts out there on Broad Street and is just like, here, discuss. Yeah.
You mean on,
like,
Front Street?
speaks so much to our existence of, mm-hmm. like, you know, I could come in and I was just like, yeah, here's what's going on with life, Mikey. And it's just like in Fight Club, whenever they talk about this. And that was our immediate mm-hmm. conversation, was like, here's what's life is happening. And this is how it totally relates to what we're also about to just get into.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so few movies, like, I can't say that. Like, I can maybe twist a lot of movies to fit that. Sure. But, like, I can't make that work for... Like, I can't talk to you about Guardians of the Galaxy and somehow twist... Like, I can probably twist it and make it fit for my life. But for the most part, that is not the experience that I have.
And I would say that we go to great lengths at Real World Theology to point out that every story... you know, has a theme.
Yeah.
Every story has things that it's trying to tell us or teach us or convey to us in some way about something someone believes or something someone's asking. But even though that's the case, it's not always a really deep question
mm-hmm.
or a question that we haven't asked, you know, in 100 other movies. So there's still a difference, even though I think, like I said, at Real World Theology, we acknowledge the fact that every movie is saying something. some things are screaming, and some things are just kind of being like, oh yeah, and I was wondering about this.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, and this is a movie that screams at us.
And that's really the beauty of Fight Club in this movie, and I think movies in general. Like, think about if Fight Club had been just a terrible movie, but it was saying the same thing. It would be panned, but it's art. It's a movie. It's beautiful. It's an artful movie. Just think of that in contrast to like a movie like what normally comes out as a Christian movie. Like, I think about, you know, God's Not Dead. And it's just it's not good. And it ends up coming across like propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Fight Club is just as equally espousing some very strong things, but it's doing so in such a beautiful way.
What,
that
an
it's
honest
able to...
way.
Yeah, that too. And it's done in an artful way, to the point where it's like, I can think about this movie and I don't have to worry about all the junk that was in it, because it was so good.
Yeah,
and that's what makes this movie so great.
Yeah, because we don't spend time getting distracted by like the really bad writing, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's where this movie really does it, is like, it says all the things that it's supposed to. It doesn't sit like it slaps you across the face with it, but it also does that in a very metaphor, very like not very, it is obvious, but I think you could easily watch this movie and not see any of the things that we're talking about. I think you could easily watch this movie. I think you could be somebody who's not looking for things like this and just watch it and enjoy it, and it still be a really, really good movie to you. But at the same time, like in such like a deep, really great metaphor, it's saying so, so much.
Yeah.
Well,
I'd say it puts itself not in a place of preaching to us, but in a place of empathizing with us.
Yeah.
And so we don't feel like we're being told something. We feel like we're being understood.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, those are some of the best things for conversation. So I'll say this to kind of wrap that part of it up. And that's that, again, I'm assuming that if you're listening to this podcast, you've seen Fight Club. So I don't necessarily want to reiterate what Josh is saying again, and by saying you should really see this movie. I would highly recommend this movie. But with the caveat, I mean, that a couple words that jump out are vulgar, crude, you know, very dark. There are some disturbing images in this movie. So it's definitely not for the faint of heart. But if you are a cinephile, if things like that don't bother you that much, then this really is, much like we've described it, one of the best pieces of art in film that I have ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, IMDb has it ranked in the top 10 all time.
Yeah.
Like, up there with Shawshank Redemption.
Mm-hmm.
Up there, I mean, one of the top 10 movies of all time, according to, like, a major website.
Yeah.
That's pretty... I mean, that says a lot about how great this movie is.
Yeah. So keep in mind, like I said, there are things in it that are going to not be for every person. But if things like that don't typically bother you, then I'd assume you've already seen this movie. And if for some reason you haven't, like, I know there's going to be younger people, you know, it still blows my mind that there's going to be people that are listening to the show that were born after 1999, you know,
yeah.
See this movie, you know,
it's well, not, maybe not yet.
Well, I don't think. No. Be like 15 or 16?
Maybe 15 or 16. People, I guess that's okay.
I assume there's...
No, 15. I saw this when I was like 14. Yeah.
There's hip kids and youth groups that are being like, hey...
Ask your mom first.
Did you listen to the...
We did not encourage you to not ask your mother.
Yeah, yeah. Always get your parents permission.
We did not ask your... We did not encourage you to not ask your mother.
Okay, so point being, you know, conceptually, whatever. So keep that in mind, but it's great. I'd highly commend it. It's, like I said, it's completely worth re-watching. If you've seen it once, check it out if you haven't seen it. And gosh, this has been such a great discussion. I almost don't want to stop, but we're going to have to, or else people are going to have like a 3-hour podcast. So I'm really always grateful to my guests who take the time to be here for these lengthy conversations. So hopefully Josh will be joining us for more of these conversations in the future, as he is now the main writing arm of Real World Theology. He's getting stuff out there every day. So,
yes, it's totally amazing. I actually write all the articles with only one arm.
Exactly. And I'm the podcasting leg.
Now, question is it the right or the left arm?
It's always the right arm. Because whichever one he uses, it's never incorrect.
Ah.
I think I just blew your mind a little.
Heart of the wise tends toward the right. The heart of the fool tends toward the left. Anyways.
So, with that said, like I said, I'm very excited to continue having you on first, Josh, and then continue having you on in the future. But outside of that, how can people who just absolutely love the things that they're seeing from you on the Real World Theology site and have just found your insight into Fight Club, probably the most awe-inspiring and mind-blowing stuff that they've ever heard, how can they follow you or get in touch with you?
You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter name is that like completely like are we completely destroying the whole message of Fight Club by the first thing that we're doing is like you can That's find right. me on Twitter.
Yeah, connect with me.
I'll give you my personal address and phone number. Yeah, find me.
We already talked about Fight Club, so we've already broken the first two rules of Fight Club. At this point, we're just piling on.
We're just done.
Exactly.
Well, okay. Well, my Twitter handle is at Jorsch Kreb. That's JORSHCREBB. It's kind of just a play on my name. You can also find me on the Facebook, Joshua Crab. If you can find the right person, you can be friends with me on Facebook. I also, besides writing at Real World Theology, I have my own personal WordPress page called 13past1.wordpress.com. Essentially use it. I used to write a lot more about movies on there. Now that I write every four days a week on movies at Real World Theology, I'm not going to put much there anymore. But that's where I do a lot of stuff that I do for like church planting here in Wisconsin, and also some other stuff that my wife writes her own blog, and I typically share her posts on there as well. But those are our two main places you can find me. Oh, and if you are, I'm like completely obsessed with Letterboxd nowadays, and yes. So if you are on Letterboxd, please find me. It's the same handle. It's Joshua Crab or Jorsch Kreb is my name on there as well. And I love having more people to talk to movies about on Letterboxd. So I'm relatively new to it, but I've been totally obsessed with it as of late and using it for everything.
All right. As am I. As is Griffin, even though he will never review anything.
I haven't got in yet. I haven't like dived in, mainly just because writing right now is just it's a foreign concept at the moment. So I won't mention any of the websites that I may have not written on in quite some time because literally, it's just I could easily get into a conversation about it, but I've already done that tonight once, and I'm not going to do it again. So I'm not writing at the moment, and there's lots of reasons for that. But I am playing a lot of music. So if you're in the Greensboro area, October 10th at the Turntable in Jamestown, I will be there with a band called Meager Fair, sharing a couple of my own songs, and really I'm playing a new instrument that night, which I'm really excited about. So I'll be playing a new instrument the whole night. I literally have learned a new instrument because of this night. So I'm really excited about it. And so if you're interested, come out. It's like $5. It's going to be a really good time. A couple of openers, and I think it'll be really worth your time. So other than that, I'm on Twitter, and I do write things there and usually quotes from movies that I'm watching or just things that you're going to be like, what is that time? Man, I don't understand what you're talking about, sir. If you're wondering what I'm saying, just ask, and I'll be happy to like direct message you and be like, yeah, I'm just angry at my boss or something of that nature. Other than that, I'm around. So, also if you want to really connect, and I'll share three pitchers of beer with you, and you cannot come stay with me because I don't have a place for you to sleep.
Not your house.
Not my house.
They can stay at my house.
They can stay at your house. About that. Yeah.
So. Wait, so you never said actually what your Twitter handle was?
Oh, Twitter is at Griffin_Kale, and it's GRIFFIN_KALE. Underscore is the one. It's if you hit shift and then dash, it's that one.
Yeah,
it's,
don't type out underscore. That's a terrible
don't type out underscore. You'll be really disappointed because I don't think that That's too long.
Man, version. What a complete mind blow. If you're like, oh man, my Twitter is at __. Oh, no, wait. No, you gotta spell out the first one and then just underscore type the next the second one.
Wait, I think you should look up and see if there is an __. Because now I want to know.
Now I want to know.
But now, Joshua, I've tasked you to do that.
I am on it.
I will say that if you want to follow me, you can follow me at Fizzification on Twitter. You can also follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter to get the latest happenings with the show.
Who's Theo?
It's like the dude who really runs Real World Theology. Huh.
The man.
But if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit the website realworldtheology.com, R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. You probably already found it because you found this show. You've hopefully read lots of stuff that Josh has been posting there. Some reviews by guys like Griffin Kale. And Mark and Laura. So we have a great writing team over there reviewing movies. Connect with us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, please, please, please review the show. Leave us some feedback. You know, tell your friends. And like we all said we wanted, we want to have the longest discuss conversation on this podcast page.
That is one conversation. If it like ended up on Facebook, I'd totally get in on it. Yeah. I'd never get in on those conversations. I would get in on this one.
Yeah, so like on the site, on Facebook, wherever, if you know, like I said, we didn't hit everything, so interact with us. You know, I have lots of guests on this show, so they can always kind of check the episodes they're on to see if people are talking about them and interact with you guys out there. Because like I said, this is a conversation. This isn't us teaching you what this movie's about. We didn't write these movies. This is just how they're affecting us. We'd love to know how they're affecting you.
And usually the people that wrote them don't even know what they're
exactly
about.
But again, as we wrap up, I want to thank my guests for being here. Josh, thank you. Griffin, thank you.
Josh, it was great to be with you, man. Really excited for all future things. And,
all future things.
Sharing maybe some of that writing space with you once I get back to the pen.
The pen.
Do it.
So in that vein, I know we mentioned this maybe at the beginning of the show. I don't know what all is going to make the final cut, but I will say that lots of people have been asking for these older movies, these movies that have been out for a while that people have been catching on DVD or were cultural milestones. As Real World Theology shifts to three times a month, there are going to be months where there are three movies that we definitely want to catch all in theater and talk about. So like in December and January. We're going to be following up in January. But in the down times like now, we got to do the Lego movie last time. We're doing Fight Club now. We're going to start doing our best to at least once a month, one of those three podcasts is going to be an older movie. So please interact with us on Twitter. Email one of us. You know, get a hold of the show. There's so many ways that you can do it. Let us know what movies you want us to review. Because at this point, we're not just keeping up with whatever's coming out now. We literally can do anything.
Yeah, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is that if Mikey starts asking me what I want to do, you're just going to get a really long string of very obvious Griffin movies. And none of you really want to hear, like, Wes Anderson talks about the same thing in most of his movies. Yeah. You don't want to hear that for
So we want to get a variety, and I'm obviously going to be sending that out to lots of our contributors and our guests on the show, and kind of see what they're interested in doing. So, if you're out there and you're among that crowd, I know you've got to be out there because I get personal conversations and messages from you guys all the time, and so I'm really excited to be able to do that and be on the lookout, interact with us. So, because of that, I thank you, the listeners, for listening, for being a part of the show, because you make this even more awesome knowing there's people out there that feel the same way. So thanks for taking the time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and you're not your things. Or entertainment's not mindless.
Yeah, I think you're not your things is appropriate.
That works too.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture,
please go to www.crossovernexus.com.